the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Thanks, Rob. That's great. Let's read together from the Old Testament, shall we? If you've got one of these green Bibles in front of you, it's page 304. That's 2 Samuel chapter 14. We have got our work cut out this morning. It's been a great service, but we're running 5-6 minutes behind at the moment, and we have got a mass of material to cover. So hold on to your seats. It's going to be a bumpy ride. And this is a long chapter, which I'm not going to read. Another difficulty with it is the story we're looking at this morning really runs from about chapter 13 to chapter 18. So we're going to be all over the place in a moment. But let's read some verses from chapter 14. Now, the difficulty is, because this is the middle of a story, you may not understand too much of it, unless you're familiar with the story to start with, until we get it later on. Just be patient and everything will fall into place, I promise. So, 14 verse 1. Joab, son of Zeruiah, he's one of the diplomats, the fixers, the political doers around David's court. Joab, son of Zeruiah, knew that the king's heart longed for Absalom. What's going on here? Well, if you were here for the last episode of this series, you'll remember that David committed a most incredible folly. The most public, embarrassing sin of his life, I guess. Going off with a married woman, having her husband murdered so he could marry her. And he was called to account by God's prophet. And everything's confessed and sorted out now. But in the wake of that, his sons do something that's just as terrible. And we'll tell you the story in a moment. As a result, Absalom, who's his favourite son, has been sent into exile. He's had to run away. And the king wants him back. The king's heart longed for Absalom. So, Joab sent someone to Tekoa and had a wise woman brought from there. He said to her, "Pretend you're in mourning. Dress in mourning clothes and don't use any cosmetic lotions. Act like a woman who has spent many days grieving for the dead. Then go to the king and speak these words to him." And Joab put the words in her mouth. And basically, she comes up with a story about who she is and what help she needs from the king, which traps him into saying something in verse 11. "As surely as the Lord lives," he said, "not one hair of your son's head will fall to the ground." Then the woman said, "Let your servant speak a word to my lord the king." "Speak," he replied. The woman said, "Why then have you devised a thing like this against the people of God?" And what she's trying to do is argue that Absalom needs to be forgiven, given a clean break, needs to come back. And the king is not fooled by this by any means. Verse 18, "Then the king said to the woman, 'Don't keep from me the answer to what I'm going to ask you. Let my lord the king speak,' the woman said." The king asked, "Isn't the hand of Joab with you in all this?" The woman answered, "As surely as you live, my lord the king, no one can turn to the right or to the left from anything my lord the king says. Yes, it was your servant Joab who instructed me to do this and to put all these words into the mouth of your servant. Your servant Joab did this to change the present situation." And this has given David the chance he needs anyway. And so, as so often happens if you follow the life of Joab, he gets his way. He makes things happen, even if it's not the right way to do it. So verse 21, "The king said to Joab, 'Very well, I will do it. Go bring back the young man Absalom.' Joab fell with his face to the ground to pay him honor, and he blessed the king. Joab said, 'Today your servant knows that he has found favor in your eyes, my lord the king, because the king has granted his servant's request.' And so Absalom comes back." Now, what's Absalom like? Verse 25, "In all Israel, there was not a man so highly praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. From the top of his head to the sole of his foot, there was no blemish in him. Whenever he cut the hair of his head," he used to cut his hair once a year because it became too heavy for him, first of the hippies, "he would weigh it, and its weight was 200 shekels by the royal standard. 3 sons and a daughter were born to Absalom. His daughter's name was Tamar or Tamar, and she became a beautiful woman." Absalom lived for 2 years in Jerusalem without seeing the king's face. That's 5 years since he saw his dad. Then Absalom sent for Joab in order to send him to the king, but Joab refused to come to him. So he sent a second time, but he refused to come. Then he said to his servants, "Look, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire." And that, strangely enough, got Joab's attention. And Joab comes, and in verse 33, "Joab went to the king and told him this. Then the king summoned Absalom, and he came in and bowed down with his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom." And they all lived happily ever after? Well, not exactly. It's time we looked at what's going on here. This has been an interesting series because I think many of us who've been brought up on the stories of David and Goliath and David and the Psalms and things like that have begun to realise just what a seamy story this actually is. And I've had lots of comments about, I never knew David was like that. And it's quite puzzling, I think, to some of us to see how somebody like this, who does so many dodgy things and makes so many wrong decisions, can be held up as such a fantastic example of kingship, the precursor of Jesus, the king to whom great David's greater son is constantly being compared through the Bible. I think we need to remember a couple of things if we're going to make sense of what happens in these stories. First, the Bible is a cumulative revelation. Some scholars say it's a progressive revelation, but that kind of assumes that the old bits go out of date when new bits come along. Jim Packer, the great Calvinist theologian, says, no, it's a cumulative revelation. One bit builds on another. Nothing goes out of date, but you gradually get it coming more and more into perspective. And we need to remember that when we look at the story of David, because there's a tremendous amount that's wrong with it. The Bible's a story of how God gets from his original creation of the universe to the new creation, where heaven and earth come together and the dwelling place of God himself is with men. And how do you get there? Well, one of the first things that happens after creation is the fall, when God's original plan and purpose for his universe is lost, when the whole of creation starts to groan and travail in pain because it's not working properly anymore, and human beings have lost the plot. And God starts the recovery scheme with a man called Abraham. And from Abraham comes a family that becomes a tribe, that becomes a nation. And passed down through the generations in this nation are the traditions and the facts that they've learned about God, so that gradually the picture is coming to focus once again of what God is like and what he's looking for. And at Mount Sinai, when they've been miraculously removed from Egypt, this nation learn a lot more about God's laws and what God wants for them. But this is temporary too. This will pass. It just gives them a clearer idea of the kinds of things that God wants from people, of what God's plan is going to be for his world. And eventually, of course, it culminates in Jesus coming into that nation, that people, that prepared soil, where there's enough understanding of what God is all about for the Son of God himself to come down to earth and make the way to God's new creation. Now, where does David come in this? Well, somewhere in the middle. The kings come about 1,000 years before Jesus. And so Israel understands a lot about God, but not everything. There's a tremendous amount still to come. The great social concern of the prophets, the wisdom books that talk about how you actually apply in life, in marriage, in business, in all sorts of ways, the kind of principles that God is shooting for. That all lies in the future. The exile still lies in the future, when the people of Israel are taken out of their country and they're up against a great world empire for the first time. And they learn at least 3 things from that. One, the world is much bigger than he thought it was, and God is much greater than he thought he was. 2, God means business when it comes to sin, and it is possible for them to lose their national home and be put right under the heel of the oppressor because God means what he says and sin is punished. And 3, though, they learn that God is faithful. God doesn't give up on his plan. God keeps going, and one of these days, the deliverer, the Messiah, Jesus, will come along. And so we're looking at a story somewhere in the middle of this. And the Israelites understand a lot of things about God, but some things they don't. This, after all, is 1,000 years before Jesus. And you might think it's pretty primitive, but actually when you look at what was happening here at that point, 1000 BC, when David came to the throne, they were building down the road in South Devon on a hill, a little Iron Age trading post. It was a pretty scrubby affair. It didn't come to anything very much, and it was another 300 years before they thought of calling it Plymouth. That's how far back this is in history. And it was a time when not much was going on. It's amazing to me, when you look at what was happening in Israel already, how God is already leading his people towards an understanding of what human beings are supposed to be about. But it's still a long way back. The second thing you have to remember, I think, is that kings were never God's idea for his people anyway. He had an idea of how they could be led, which Moses taught to them at Mount Sinai, a plan which involved the land constantly belonging to the families of Israel, so that nobody got richer and nobody got poorer. A system in which every 50 years, everybody went back to gold, did not pass gold, did not collect £200. And it was right back to the absolute start once again. And that system broke down. And the people started saying, we want to have a king to be like the nations around us. And Samuel tried to say to them, you're not supposed to be like the nations around you. You're a special people for God. But he said, no, we want a king. We want a king. And God said to Samuel, Samuel, listen to them. It's not you they're rejecting, it's me. And Samuel warned them that if you have a king, there'll be rich and poor in the country. The king will want your young men in his army. Your young daughters will be taken into the palace to work for him, not for you. The whole system will go crazy. And he said, we want a king to be like the nations round about us. So God gave them a king. And in the days of David, we know the whole economic situation was just going towards everything that Samuel said. There were rich, there were poor. There was conscripted labour. There were people who had very little and people who had a great deal. It was all getting crazy because they'd gone their own way instead of God's way. No wonder there were tensions in society. No wonder there were evil things done. And the story that we've got to look at this morning is up against that kind of background. Okay, so what actually happened in the life of David? We looked at this the last time I was speaking 3 weeks ago, and we said there were basically six phases to it. He starts out as a farmer boy. He's taken into Saul's court, and he becomes the pinup of lots of girls in Jerusalem. Saul gets jealous, and he has to go on the run for years as a kind of bandit chief. And when Saul is dead, he becomes the king. And then he moves his capital from Hebron to Jerusalem, which is where the stories we're looking at this morning are set. He has to go on the run again, though, because this one that we've been reading about this morning, Absalom, starts a rebellion against his old dad. That's on beyond chapter 14. And after Absalom is dead, David is back in Jerusalem, and as an old man, he ends the kingship and hands it on to his son Solomon. Well, the bit we're looking at this morning is that bit. And what we're looking at is his relationships with his family, because that's one of the most interesting things about David's kingship, the way he got on or didn't get on with his kids. So I want to look at four things, if time allows. First of all, the story. We need to tell the story or we don't get anywhere. Second, the dad. What was David like as a father? Third, the kids. Who were his children? Given that there were possibly 50 of them, we're not going to get through every single one of them this morning, but you never know, and I hope you brought your sleeping bag. Anyhow, the fourth thing is, what lessons can we draw from all of this? Not just about parents and children, because not all of us are in that kind of family situation, but lessons for all of us from what we're going to look at. Let's look at the story first, anyhow. I can boil it down to about 10 points, but that's as few as I can get it. Number one. The Bathsheba, the lady with whom David committed adultery and subsequently married after getting rid of her husband, has a child, and that child dies. And David takes that as God's judgment on him, and he repents. And then things start going better again. Another baby's born, Solomon. And Joab, who's not just a diplomat but also a military leader, is up fighting the Ammonites, and he captures Rabbah, the Ammonite capital, and then all the Ammonite towns one by one. And David thinks, whoa, it's great, I'm forgiven, I'm home free, God's let me off the hook and everything's fine. But when you do something evil, the evil results tend to hang around, and not least in your family. And in chapter 13, which we didn't read, something horrendous happens. One of David's sons, Amnon, the heir to the throne, rapes his half-sister Tamar. And it's a tremendous story, because before the rape, he's absolutely obsessive about Tamar. Afterwards, he can't stand her. All of the guilt and self-loathing he feels, he transfers to her. And he won't have anything to do with her and just throws her out of his presence. And she goes off to Absalom and tells Absalom what has happened. And Absalom gives a little speech about, oh, has Ammi been rude to you? He uses the word Aminom rather than Amnon, and that's a diminutive. Little Ammi, has little Ammi been rude to you? And that's the strength of the word he uses. Don't worry about it, don't worry. Just come and live with me and everything will be fine. But actually, Absalom's seething with hatred for Amnon. And the next thing that happens, oops, hang on a minute. Oh no, let's tell the rape story to start with. Okay, this is a Palestinian princess of those days. And you can see that Tamar, the girl concerned, grew up in a fairly privileged environment. Nice silk dress, lots of gold and silver, arm bracelets, hair plaited in a beautiful way. They were well off, those kids. The trouble was, if you were a princess, you didn't get out of the harem. You stayed in that morning, noon, and night. And that was one of Amnon's problems, because he met his half-sister at family gatherings, but he wasn't allowed near her. And he wanted desperately to get hold of her. And so one of his friends said, okay, this is what you do. You go to your apartment and pretend to be sick. Don't eat. Get pale. And then when they say, what can we do for you? Say, I want my sister to come and cook me some food. And if she comes and makes food with her own hands, then everything will be fine. And so she does that. Amnon still won't eat. And he flies into an unreasonable rage and says, get out, everybody, get out, apart from Tamar. And they're so flustered that they do. And then, when that happens, he jumps on Tamar. And at first she thinks he's joking. Then she realizes he's in deadly earnest. And she says, don't do this. This is daft. This is going to ruin my life and yours. And of course, she's absolutely right. But he goes ahead with it. And having done it, he can't stand the sight of her. So he says to his servant, get this woman out of here. And she goes off tearing her clothes, putting ashes on her head, having her hand on her head, which meant in those days you were absolutely desperate with grief. And she goes and tells Absalom all about it. Well, next thing that happens is that David does nothing. He did not curb the excesses of his son Amnon. He favored him because he was his firstborn. So what happens after this? Well, Absalom realizes something has to be done, but he bides his time. And eventually, he manages to lure Amnon to a feast, gets him drunk, and has his servants kill Amnon. Absalom realizes he has to run, and so he's in exile for 3 years. Then chapter 14 happens. Joab conspires to get Absalom home, as we've just seen. After 2 years, David and Absalom are reconciled. So what happens after 14? Well, Absalom conspires against David. He thinks, Dad's a pushover. I can get him off the throne and I can be king instead. Everybody in Israel likes me. I'm the dazzling boy, so I can get people to follow me. And he does. He makes an excuse to leave Jerusalem to go down to Hebron, David's old capital, and there he builds his forces and suddenly marches on David. There's Jerusalem where David is. There's Hebron down south. And Absalom's army marches suddenly against Jerusalem before David realizes what's going on. Now, David is complacent. He's not strengthened the city in 20 years because it hasn't been attacked in 20 years. There's no way that he can get the food together to withstand a siege in the time that he's got. Absalom's already on the march, and so David does the only thing he can do. He flees the city, and he goes 20 miles in one day, 3,700 feet downhill. And you know, if you've ever walked down a mountain, how difficult that is. An old king, his concubines and his wives, apart from 10 concubines, whom you'll hear about in a moment, and they all run off down to Gilgal, to the fords of the Jordan. He's still got men left in the city, and he wants to find out what's going on. And those men report to him that Absalom, having got to Jerusalem and taken possession of it, has done two things. Number one, he's taken all of David's 10 concubines out onto the palace roof, the very roof where David first started thinking of his great sin just a few years before. And he's had sex with them in public, in full view of all of the people of Jerusalem. That, the Bible says, is to make himself such a stench in David's nostrils that there would be no going back. There could be no reconciliation now. Absalom was in deadly earnest. It's the kingdom or bust. The second thing he did was to decide to delay a little bit, to build up his army, because he knew that David had with him some pretty fierce fighters. And so he wasn't going to attack David until he was ready. And that gave David the chance he needed to get across the Jordan and away up into the hills at Mahanaim. And Mahanaim was a good place because it was a difficult place to attack. It was at the end of a long, thin valley, the valley of the river Jabbok. And for all Absalom's overwhelming numbers, only a few soldiers could advance at a time along that valley. And so they tried to attack David from above instead. And the battle, the conclusive battle takes place in the forest just above Mahanaim. And there, Absalom has no advantages. Because in the forest, his men can't stay in touch with one another. It's just wandering through the trees looking for soldiers to kill. And David's men are guerrilla fighters. They have been for years, from the days when they were dodging Saul. And so they clean up. And Absalom himself, is riding under a low, overhanging bough of a tree when his hair, that long hair that he was so proud of, gets entangled in the branches. And suddenly the donkey's gone on without him, and he's swinging in the tree, unable to help himself. Joab knows that David has told them not to hurt Absalom, because David still loves Absalom despite all of this. But Joab is having none of this. And so he goes and stabs Absalom with 3 javelins, just to make sure. Then gets 10 other soldiers to put their swords in as well, just to make sure he doesn't get the whole blame. And Absalom is dead. So Absalom dies, and then the rest of the story is that David mourns and returns to Jerusalem. At first, David's absolutely inconsolable. "Absalom, Absalom, my son, I wish I'd died instead of you." And Joab has to say to him, "David, come on, there are guys here who've lost their lives today fighting for you. Their relatives feel just as mournful as you do, and you're paying no attention to their needs. You're not giving them any credit. This is a day of victory. You've got to celebrate, even if you don't feel like it." And so David returns to Jerusalem and takes over the throne again. There's more trouble, though. There's another revolt with a man called Sheba saying, "We have nothing to do with David. David is an old, discredited king." And that's a rebellion that has to be put down. And Amasa, I won't even tell you about it, it's just going to take too long, but you can read that bit for yourself. The final bit of trouble, though, is that when one of David's sons, Adonijah, sees that his dad is getting old, he decides to do an Absalom. He decides to become king even before his father is dead. But hearing about it, David anoints Solomon and proclaims him king, and Adonijah, in terror, begs to be forgiven. But that doesn't stop him having another go later on. And so what David has done is to start something that rumbles on and on. The murders go on. The rapes and the illicit sex go on. The attempts to seize power go on. And it's all because David's sin may have been forgiven by God, but sometimes the effects of what you do in this world here just continue to reverberate afterwards. Okay, we're already 2 minutes over the finish time for this talk. Let's have a look at those other 3 points very, very quickly, at the speed of light. What do we know about David as a dad? I want to say 3 things about him. First, he was a king who'd lost his direction. He'd settled down. You look at the record of David's earlier years and you see somebody who had vision and purpose and energy. And what captivated people about him was that he was on the go. He wanted to achieve something for God. And now he was in Jerusalem and happy and settled. The vision just dimmed. The direction disappeared. And it's all too possible, isn't it, that we can be like that? We can do great things for God in our teens, in our 20s, in our 30s. But then the pressures of life arrive and we just settle down a little bit. And in every church in the world, I guess, there are people who once did tremendous stuff for God who've dwindled into doing nothing very much. And David just lost his direction. I wonder if any of us are in danger of losing ours. There's a lot more you could say about that. And I think it's a bit like Versailles. I don't know if you've been watching that TV series. I find it fascinating. I found it totally incomprehensible, the first series, because there are so many people, I couldn't work out who was who. And they all had long hair like Absalom, so it was no use. But the second series, it started to make a bit of sense. And it shows quite clearly how isolated you can be when you are a king, with everybody looking to you, trying to get something from you. And just as he made silly decisions, he could be vindictive and spiteful one moment, and then lenient and gracious the next. So David did just that. You never knew what was coming next. David became completely unpredictable. And in the last episode, last week, the king's brother, who's partly his conscience, said this to him. "It's the anniversary of the day you took over as king. Do you remember what you said to me that night? You said the secret is not just to be king, it's to be seen to be king. And that, my dear brother, is what you've forgotten. You've taken off your clothes and shown us your frailty. I suggest you put them back on." But that's easier said than done. Taken off your clothes and shown us your frailty. That's exactly what David had done. A king who'd lost his direction. But also, he was a father who'd lost his authority. His children had seen the duplicity, the hypocrisy, the horrendous double life he'd been living over this woman, Bathsheba. And they'd lost all respect for him. This is why the things that we see in chapters 13 and 14 actually happen. And if you look at who was in David's family, you can realize he's pretty remote from them anyway. Breaks my heart to go through this so fast because it took so long getting this slide together. But here are the wives he had in Hebron. There was Michal, Saul's daughter. who never had children because she fell out terminally with David, and David presumably just did not sleep with her for the rest of her life. He'd also married one of Saul's wives, Ahinoam from Jezreel. Well, he'd married several of them, but she's the one that counts because she had a child, Amnon. And I've called him the unchecked one, because Amnon was the one who saw his sister and went to get her, who thought he could do anything because of the heir to the throne. Then there was Abigail, and she was the wife of a man called Nabal, and David was about to destroy Nabal and all of his servants. Abigail went to plead for mercy, and David liked her. When Nabal heard that she'd been to see David, he had an apoplectic fit and died on the spot, and so David very conveniently married Abigail. She had a son called Daniel, or Kileab, who never seems to have been in the line for the throne. And so he's the one that nobody had much time for, the unnoticed kind of one. And I think part of that seems to have been, at least this is Jewish tradition, that they got married so fast that nobody was very sure whether Daniel, Kileab, whatever you call him, was actually Nabal's son or David's son. But he was claimed as David's anyway. Then there was Maacah. She was the most high-born of all of the wives, because she was a princess from a little principality up towards the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee. And she had two children. And just as she was a golden girl, they were golden kids. Absalom, the beautiful, and Tamar, the desirable. And I've called Absalom there I can't even read it from here. What did I call him? Thank you. You can read it. Good. The unnoticed one. The unnoticed one is Daniel Kileab. The indulged one. That's right. Because David let him off with almost anything. Tamar, you can't see the bottom line, I'm afraid, because for some reason it's cutting off the bottom of my slide here. But she's the insignificant one. Because what happened when Amnon raped her? David did nothing. She went to stay with Absalom. Did David even talk to his daughter about the horrible thing she'd been through? Probably not. It was just too embarrassing. And Tamar had lost all of her chances in that moment. Probably she was engaged to be married to some prince somewhere at that point. She was about the age for it. And she had a future ahead of her in the royal court. Now, she had to be locked up in the harem for years and years to come, or in Absalom's house. She wasn't allowed to go out in public. Nobody would want to marry her. Her life had just ended. Did David have any sympathy? No, she was just an embarrassment. And there was Haggit, whose name means dancer, and it's conjectured that she was somebody who attracted David by her dancing, but we don't really know. She had the son Adonijah, who was the ambitious one, who tried to take the throne from his father later on. There were two others, Abital, who had Shephatiah, and Eglah, who had Ithream, and I'm not going to tell you about them because they're not that important, and basically these two guys never stood a chance of the kingship. But you can see, already you've got a lot of family there, and David has a relationship, it would appear, with none of them. And that was just the start. Because when he got to Jerusalem, he also married Bathsheba, didn't he? And Bathsheba produced four kids, including Solomon, who was going to be the next king. There were others, we don't know how many wives, but lots of them. And they produced at least nine children, and he was running out of names by the end of the whole thing, because Eliphelet appears in the list twice. So, and goodness knows what he called the children of his concubines, but we don't know how many they were or who they were, because they don't count. And so when you count it all up, how big a family did David have? Well, it would be approximately, I reckon, 30 wives and concubines, a conservative estimate, and 30 to 50 children. You can't have a relationship with 50 kids, can you, really? Not even if you're the most brilliant youth worker in the world. And so you've got a king who'd lost his direction, a father who'd lost his authority, and a leader who'd lost his credibility. His double life was exposed in the front of Israel, and that was one reason for his inactivity. Because when people know what you're like, they're not going to trust you. You cannot take action because it looks hypocritical. You've done the same thing yourself. And all too often that happens in Christian life. Back in January, this guy was hailed as a unique and inimitable preacher, a tremendous intellect and a gentleman. He was an adjunct professor of Westminster Theological Seminary, former moderator of the Free Church of Scotland, had a big parish in the Isle of Lewis, had written 17 books, was somebody who was a well-known man in the Christian world. What happened to him in January? He took an overdose of drugs trying to end his life. When he was taken into hospital to be pumped out, he managed to slip into a toilet and hang himself. He was only in his 50s, and these stories started to appear. It appeared that Dr. Ian D. Campbell had at least 7 affairs with women in his church and a child with one of them. And the Free Church since then has been sorting out the mess, taking disciplinary action, counselling those who've been hurt, and it just goes on and on and on. Somebody who was living 2 lives, and eventually they caught up with him. Let's look at the kids very, very quickly, because we haven't really got time to talk about them. But there's Amnon. He was the one who was unchecked, who could do whatever he wanted, the playboy of the royal court. What did he not get from his father? No boundaries. He had no boundaries set for him whatsoever. And when you don't show your kids the way they should behave, the way God has planned for them to behave, then you end up in a mess. Absalom? Well, what do you say about Absalom, the one who was indulged? What did his father not give him? No discipline whatsoever. What about, I'm going to miss this bit because there's too much there. If you want to know about the Facebook group for parents of ungrateful children, I'll give you the address afterwards. Okay. And it's Tamar. Tamar, the insignificant one. What did she get from her father? No attention whatsoever. And there are lessons about parenting there that we're skipping over, but you get the point, don't you? Fourth, Adonijah, the ambitious one. Why did he try to take the throne from his father when it had all ended in tears for Absalom? Well, he had no encouragement from his father at all. He was stuck out on the side, the son of the dancer, somebody who was royal, in the line to the throne, but nobody ever thought he stood a chance. And as a result, he had to make his own way because his father wasn't going to encourage him. So what lessons do we learn from all of this? Because thankfully, I'm coming to an end and we'll have a cup of coffee in a minute. What 3 lessons can you learn from this? I think, first of all, great gifts are not enough. It's what you do with them. David was a tremendously talented guy, and that was what drew people to him. But it's the way you use your gifts. It's the way you keep your motivation. It's the way you forge ahead. It's the way you have a vision of what you want to achieve for God. It's the way you develop the fruit of the Spirit alongside the gifts of the Spirit, that the character goes alongside the actions. Those are the kinds of things that decide whether you count and tell for anything in this world. Great gifts are not enough. It's what you do with them. Second thing, growing life depends on deepening relationships. David's family fell apart because there was no communication. There was no shared life. There was no appreciation. There was no flow of humanity from one person to another. That can happen in a church too. And if you have signed up as a Belmont member and you're not going to house group, that's one thing you need to think about. The only way we're going to build a dynamic, purposeful church here is if we're in contact with one another, if we're building small communities of love all over the city. And you say, oh, well, that's me. I'm all right. I'm fine. I've got that box ticked. What are you actually doing to help in the church? We've got vacancies just about everywhere because we've got a growing and a positive ministry. It's fantastic, the opportunities we've got with toddlers, with teenagers, with all sorts of groups. And we need more people who'll work, who'll help. And when you work in a team with other Christians, the relationships tend to grow in the most unusual ways, and you're blessed. It's not just that you're putting service in, but you become part of a vibrant community that's going somewhere. Growing life depends on deepening relationships. It's true in families, it's true in churches. Third thing and the final thing, David still, with all his failings, with everything he got horrendously wrong, David still is a signpost pointing to the Lord Jesus. And even our failing lives can be more powerful than we deserve. And we can look at all the mistakes we've spoken about this morning and say, yep, that's me. I haven't murdered anybody, but I've done this, I've done that, I've done the other thing. And we can accuse ourselves of all kinds of things. And the devil will help us in that process. But what we need to remember is that even with all the failures and slip-ups and messes that we make, God can work through your life and mine to build something beautiful.